Welcome to Showdown. I'm Mark Kaysen. And today is Tuesday, April 2nd. So we made it past April Fool's. And Heather Fleming, how are you doing? How did you do on April Fool's? Anything good?
You know what? I stayed close to the house, and so I did just great.
Okay, well, that's excellent. Yeah, we don't want you getting in any trouble. We know you're doing some great work, and we're going to talk about that today. And I definitely love to talk about school because I've been a teacher for a long time, university, high school, all over. And I have to say that the situation in high schools today are often good and many times not so good.
Yeah.
So, definitely. Yeah. Now, first of all, let's talk about what you do. You've got an organization that you started, and talk to me about it. It has to do with equity.
Yes.
Tell me.
So, in 2021, when the first anti-critical race theory bill was introduced, you know, I recognized at that time the critical race theory was just a buzzword that they were using to really encouch diversity, equity, and inclusion, and to basically ban it in our state. And so I started a little Facebook group that eventually turned into the Missouri Equity Education Partnership. And what we do is that we advocate for equity at every level, like everywhere that equity is under threat, we go in and we advocate, and we teach others to try to advocate for equity as well.
Yeah. Did you almost fall over a couple of days ago when you read that Attorney General Bailey was claiming that the fight that everybody's been talking about in Hazelwood East, that fight was a direct result of diversity, equity, and inclusion?
No. I wasn't that surprised because the reality is that they use diversity, equity, and inclusion as a scapegoat for anything that they fear. They also use it as an opportunity to grasp for power. And so I'm not surprised that he's using that incident, such a tragic incident, in order to basically try to increase his profile, bring more supporters, rile his base up. At this point, it's a code word for Black people, brown people. And so when they're saying that, oh, the fight was because of DEI, no, what they really want to say is the fight was because we're allowing Black people to and brown people to be part of society. And it's a message that, unfortunately, with some individuals is really hitting, but that is the work that we try to do. We try to make sure that people understand that, no, we're all in this together. And a lot of the people that work with our organization are people, white people, and people that are not maybe part of some of the impacted groups that the Attorney General is attacking. And so we try to let people know that, no, we're what America should look like. A group of individuals that, regardless of their race, their color, their ethnicity, their sexual orientation, their gender, their religion, that all of us should have the opportunity to thrive in our society. So I wasn't surprised. It's something that they've been doing for a very long time.
Yeah. And I'm really glad you said it the way you did, because the fact is that people, white people in this country, a certain large number of them, are and have been looking for a long time for ways to push back against the civil rights movement. And the fact also is that diversity, that is lots of different people being involved, equity, fairness among these people, and inclusion, that everybody gets to be involved, the thought that that could have anything to do with harming society is just bizarre beyond belief.
Well, for these individuals, it does harm society for them. For some people, equality, equity feels like oppression. And it feels like oppression to them because they've gotten used to that feeling of privilege. They don't want to acknowledge it as privilege. And I know that that becomes a really bad word, but they've gotten used to things being, you know, centered around their particular cultural or ethnic identities, them being the due north. I had an interaction online yesterday because a school board candidate in one of the districts out here in St. Charles posted, you know, Happy Easter, this wonderful message around Easter, but he put for those who celebrate. And this gentleman, like, was so very upset because he had the audacity to say for those who celebrate, like, they don't need that. And he's not understanding that that is not in any way negatively impacting Christianity. What that particular thing was doing was just acknowledging that not everyone is Christian. And so, but when you are used to everything being centered around Christianity and you as a Christian, sometimes that can feel very, very offensive. And so I told him, I was like, the reality is that it wasn't offensive. You were offended. And there's a huge difference. And right now we have a lot of people in society where, you know, a man or a trans woman having on nail polish is not offensive. You're just offended because you've chosen to not be inclusive, to not come from an inclusive perspective. That individual is doing absolutely nothing to harm you and absolutely nothing that impacts you and your identity. But because that's not something that you consider part of your identity, now you're offended by that person's very existence. And I think that's what we've been dealing with. How do you argue with people that, as you're trying to argue from a perspective of humanity, can't understand because they don't see your humanity?
Yeah, I think
they don't acknowledge it.
They may also be overwhelmed by the work that they're doing, selling $60 Bibles. I don't know. It might be, you know. Yeah.
Might be,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, could be.
They're busy over there.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that we really have tried to, like, if you think about everything that's going on right now, everything that's happening in our state is a matter of not that these individuals are problematic, but that you want to go in and to control how people live their lives, how they express their experience. And that's not fair to the citizens of Missouri. I went before the legislature and I asked them, one of the committees, and I said, what are you actually doing to help Missourians with the problems that we actually have? Our rural communities do not have adequate access to internet, you know? In our rural communities as well, we have people trying to do the voucher system, but they don't have alternatives. So pretty much the money is going to be taken out of their schools without them having an opportunity to use vouchers because there's no private schools in their communities. Our rural communities also don't have access to hospitals. They have to drive 45 minutes an hour to go to a hospital. Why aren't we looking at those issues? Why aren't jobs leaving?
You make a great point, because the thing that's so hard to understand truly is, why would the people that you're describing that live in these rural areas, why wouldn't they be looking at the problems that Black people face in this country and saying to themselves, we're going through the same issues, and maybe if we got together, we could actually have an impact on making a change? And instead, look what they're doing. I mean, why are they trying to come after you? What do they think that's going to accomplish for themselves?
Well, one of the things that when you study history that you realize is that this has been a tactic that they have used since the beginning of slavery. And so the one step is the dehumanization of Black people, brown people, basically saying they're not like you. They're not human like you. They don't have the same human, you know, characteristics, etc. They're somehow so different from you as to be in a different category. And so we have a lot of that rhetoric now happening, sometimes in very subtle ways, sometimes very blatantly. So that's the first thing. The next thing that you have to convince people of is that not only are these individuals so different than you, but they are so different than you that they don't deserve the same things that you deserve. And that sometimes you've got to take one for the team. There's a great book called Dying of Whiteness by, I believe it's Jonathan Metzl. But it talks about the fact that some people have been so programmed around racism, you know, homophobia, transphobia, Islamophobia, et cetera, that they are willing to sacrifice what benefits them in order to ensure that it doesn't benefit the people who they, you know, have their hatred and ire have been targeted towards. And so that's what we find. We have a lot of people in our state that they see that it, you know, that, okay, this would benefit Black people. It would also benefit me, but they've also been given a silent promise that we're going to hurt the people that you want to hurt, but that won't hurt you. The problem is a lot of people start realizing that no, when the hammer falls, it falls on all of us. And what we should be organizing around is socioeconomic differences, as opposed to racial differences, ethnic differences, etc.
Yeah, and when Donald Trump said that the blood of America is being poisoned by immigrants coming from Africa, you know, I just don't even know how much more you have to put out there to convince people that something really horrible is happening.
It's happening. And that's the thing about it. Like, you know, people started being like, oh, you're overreacting a little bit, when it's like, okay, y'all, there's a lot of similarities between what happened in 1930s Germany and what's happening now in our country. And they're like, yeah, everybody always, you know, states Hitler or goes to Hitler and you're just overreacting. No, we can actually show that there's a lot, like, for instance, we are having people that are wholeheartedly trying to ban books. That is one of the first steps that happened.
Wentzville,
that led us to genocide.
Wentzville's done it. Francis Howell has done it.
I live in Francis Howell, so okay. I'm here right at ground zero having to deal with this stuff. And it's bad. It's just very, it's bad. It's wrong. But the whole thing is that it's part of a very concentrated plan. If anyone cares to read Project 2025 out of, I believe it's the Heritage Foundation.
Absolutely it is.
It is terrifying to see what they plan. They put it out there.
Yes, they
have.
And
we have a lot of people that still are like, well, you know, they don't really mean that. Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
Yeah, because, and I've talked about this even recently, and that is that this Project 2025 wants to destroy what they call somehow this administrative state that they believe is wrecking America, and the reality is that we have tens of thousands of people who take these exams, these civil service exams, in order to get a job so that they can work for an agency so that they can help all of us to live in the country that Congress has really laid out in the laws. And to think that we can just wipe out these agencies and that Donald Trump can just put all of his favorite people in charge of all of this, well, it's just the most bizarre idea. And yet, you're correct. The Heritage people, they believe that this is the solution to some kind of a problem that's affecting our country. It's amazing.
you know, the big thing for people to realize is that Donald Trump is pretty much a useful idiot for the people on the right. They appeal to his ego. They appeal to what, you know, will get him going, get him to use his, you know, charisma, his connection to his base, et cetera, to, you know, really get the things done that they want to. Donald Trump doesn't have any plans. If you listen to him speak, there's no plans, so-called. He appeals to prejudices, you know, to hatred, to fear, all of those things. But as far as laying out a specific plan, he looks for others to do that. And so that's the role that Heritage Foundation, ALEC, and a few of the other right-wing, you know, think tanks that they have fulfilled for him. So he's going to be the spearhead to put some of these things through that are just absolutely awful. They're awful.
So I'm sure
it's trickling down.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm sure that you talk to the legislature about these things. And so my question is, what do they say to you when you lay the plan out to them in terms of what's being done that's going to hurt them as well?
Our legislators, you know, we have a Republican, I think we're just one shy of a Republican supermajority. We pretty much have a supermajority. We've had one for 20 years now. And basically what they're all doing is they're all scrambling to maintain power. I don't want to say all, because we do have a lot of really good legislators. But many of our individuals on the right are struggling to maintain power by any means necessary. And so when they look at this plan, they look at these plans again with the idea it's going to hurt them and not me. And we keep trying to stress like what the harm will be. Right now, our state is experiencing teacher shortages all over. We can't keep good teachers. I spoke to a law class, some really bright individuals at Washington University, spoke to them. I asked of that class of like 30 students, how many of them planned on staying in Missouri? And there were two.
Wow.
And that's only because they lived here.
Yeah.
They were raised here.
Who was the professor in that class? Do you remember?
Denise Lieber.
Okay.
Yeah.
No,
Lieberman. Yeah. She is just such a little dynamo. I love her so much. She does excellent work around, you know, voters and making sure that people have the right to vote. And it's all people to make sure that we are not disenfranchised, that we are able to fully participate in our democracy. And so I appreciate Denise for that.
There's some great people in that Washington University Law School, that is for sure. I've done a lot of work with David Majerian. Are you familiar with him?
I'm not.
Okay. Well, he's another great one. And I can tell you also, I'm doing even right now a lot of work with the people in the Black Studies Department at WashU. And I'm guessing you may know them. Have you worked with them?
Who?
Shanti. And
sure.
Gerald Early.
I know Gerald. I know of Gerald Early.
Okay.
There's so many people, and it's so funny. One of the best parts of this, and I used to hear all the time, well, you know, talking about this stuff just divides us. I don't know who you're talking to, because some of the closest relationships that I currently have come from people that want to sit down and have these difficult conversations and then want to do something in order to work to make sure that everyone is together. So Gerald Early is a name that I've heard, and I would welcome the opportunity to speak to him and work with him.
Yeah, Gerald's pretty famous because if you remember back to the story, maybe 20 years ago, he and his family were shopping at Frontenac, and his family was inside. He was outside waiting for them. Turns out he was in front of a jewelry store, and the police came and arrested him because obviously a Black man was getting ready to rob a jewelry store. So
Yeah. And so that ends up being one of the aspects that we really try to talk about. Like, you know, I'm a Black woman in leadership, and how some of the anti-Blackness, et cetera, that is ingrained in our society, how that can impact people that are just trying to do the best that they can. Like, there's so many individuals that I hear stories about that it's like they were doing something fairly innocuous, and, you know, next thing they know, they're accused of something, or they're facing challenges that they should not be facing, you know? Yeah, we look at what's happening right now with Nikayla Napper in Maplewood. She is one of the most caring individuals that I've ever met. She loves Maplewood, and she is facing so much backlash that comes from a real place of you know, it's disingenuous, some of the criticisms that she is facing. And we see that a lot with our Black leaders. And so you have to be vigilant about making sure, like, that you're applying that lens to say, well, wait a minute, is this criticism like a legitimate criticism, or is it coming from a place of, you know, I've got a unconscious bias that I really need to check. And I have to do it all the time. You know, I have to do it all the time with, you know, with checking my bias, and where I might be, you know, overly critical of something that comes from a place that's just really not genuine.
Yeah. I've got to tell you, I've never gone wrong believing that in general, white people are looking for trouble in this country. I've never gone wrong. Not in all the years I've been here. I unfortunately, and the other thing that they don't understand is, and you mentioned it a little earlier, and that is this whole privilege business. Because, you know, here I am, a 72-year-old white guy with a bald head and a suit on, and all I have to do is walk into the Clayton courthouse, and everybody there thinks I'm a judge. Okay. And I mean, this is, you talk about bias. Okay. They don't know, but they see something that's caught in their brain. And unfortunately, they're doing the opposite when it comes to Black people. And as you say, brown people as well. And then the other thing, which is amazingly, it's an equal problem. And that is, you know, Asians. When people see Asians, they think, well, that person's a mathematical genius. No, that's not how it works. If they're a mathematical genius, they've done some work to become a mathematical genius. It's not because of how they look. It's not because of where their ancestors were born. And that's something that we're really dealing with, in a widespread way across this entire country. It's out of control.
I think about this. There was a student of mine that, with you being a teacher, you understand that you're constantly in a process of, especially if you're trying to be a good teacher, you're constantly in the process of, you know, reflecting on where have I, you know, really succeeded versus where is there some room for improvement? And I'll never forget that one year there was a student of mine who fell below the radar. He was struggling. But this was a way that even a positive bias can harm him because of the fact that he was a young Asian man. It fell under my radar to really look at what was going on with him, because I just made the assumption that he's fine. And come to find out, it took me, you know, 2 or 3 weeks to really realize, okay, this kid is struggling, and to put a good plan in place for it. But that's what people don't realize DEI really is, especially in our classrooms. What diversity, equity, and inclusion does is that, first of all, it honors how we are all different. And then it puts things into place to ensure fairness. And I used to tell my students, I asked them this question. We did an activity at the beginning of the semester where it was like, okay, go to one side if you agree, go to the other side if you disagree. And I would make the statement, as a teacher, I should treat all of my students equally. And so I'd have kids, of course, move to the, yeah, I agree with that. And I would tell them, no, I shouldn't. Because you want to be treated as an individual. And in the end, each of you needs something different. And so as a good teacher, what I'm going to do is sit and assess, what do you need? Some of you, you don't need me looking over your shoulder. You need me to just leave you alone until you have a question. And then you come back and you ask me that question. Other people, they need me to sit down with them and kind of go through some of the stuff and talk to them so they can process the information. And so as a teacher, my job is to figure out, what do you need in order for you to best succeed, and to provide that. And that's the simple reality that a lot of the people, like, you know, today, many of us have gone to vote for school board candidates. And a lot of the rhetoric around school board is, we just need to get back to the basics. Well, guess what? If you get back to the so-called basics, you're going to have a lot of kids failing. Because part of good teaching is not just, I knew a lot of great teachers that understood their subject area but didn't understand students.
Sure. Well, that's everything. And you know, being able to connect with young people and to get them to know that you do care about what's happening to them, and the work that you're doing is not only meaningful in terms of what the classroom is doing, but it's meaningful in terms of what the teacher is trying to accomplish as a teacher, as a person that's a mentor to young people. And I know in my case, it's high school kids. I wouldn't even know what to do with the little ones. I mean, I've had little ones, but you know, you get into school with other people's little ones. I don't know, but you give me a teenager.
I used to tell people all the time that, you know, if hell is a place where they like individualize it for you, then my personal hell would be a room filled with cats, this black walnut tree that I'm highly allergic to, or right, black elder tree, and kindergartners, a room full of kindergartners.
Right.
Because same thing, I can't, my jam is high school.
That's kids. Me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, listen, Heather, you know, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on and talk to us. And, you know, I look forward to maybe coming back to you some more as just things are happening out here. And so I'll know that you're somebody that can really speak to some of the problems in our education system.
I would love that, Mark. You know, the biggest thing right now that I want people to keep in mind is that we have an educational system that needs work, but the way that we work on it is not by privatizing it and sending it, you know, giving it to other people and making it responsible so that it's only accessible by a few people. And so right now, what we should be doing as individuals is getting serious people around the table to talk about, what do we need to change and how do we change it for the better so that it really benefits and educates every child in our state, in our country. And so thank you for me, and I can't wait to speak to you some more.
Well, thank you very much, Heather, and we will catch up with you again soon.
Sounds good.
Okay. So first, before we move on here, I want to talk a little bit about where you can get something great to eat tonight. When you're done with Showdown and whatever else you have to do this evening, you can go to 18,000 Chesterfield Airport Road and get the best food at Wendy's. Now, you're talking about baby back ribs. You're talking about onion rings. You're talking about pizza and smoked meats and patty melts and just everything imaginable, wings, all the good food that you could think of. Pizza, come on, you can't miss with pizza. So look, Wendy's is at 18,000 Chesterfield Airport Road, great restaurant, really is, and terrific environment just to go sit down and eat with people. Ben is there. He's the owner, and he will love to talk to you. He talks to everybody. He's just a friendly, outgoing guy that wants to be sure that that restaurant is the best that it can be. And it is. That's Wendy's, 18,000 Chesterfield Airport Road in Chesterfield Valley. Now, if you're interested in jewelry, you can go straight to 4506 Hampton, and that's Jewels on Hampton, where they buy and sell jewelry and coins. They will create jewelry for you in the most creative way that you can imagine. You give them some license, and they'll go out and make sure that you come up with some great pieces of jewelry. Or you can tell them exactly what you want, and Al will make sure it is exactly what you want. So again, that's Jewels on Hampton, 4506 Hampton in St. Louis. And there's both Al and AJ. They're there all the time, ready to help. And as I always point out, you know, I've got my 45-year-old Seiko watch. It's a very nice gold Seiko watch. And believe me, 45 years, they don't work without somebody doing something. So trust me, the place to go get your watch fixed is Jewels on Hampton, 4506 Hampton. Now, you'll notice that today I'm wearing a pink shirt as well as a pink and black tie along with my charcoal suit. And I, of course, got this from the St. Louis Suit Company in Clayton. And they are on the corner of Forsyth and Central. And I promise you, they've got the greatest clothes that you can imagine. Everything that you would want to wear to work, with a tie and a shirt and your suit. And of course, this is 2024, so forget the dress shoes. I'm done with that. I wear my Chuck Taylors. And as my students at school say, yeah, Kaysen, wear those Chucks. You know, I wear the black Chucks, and they want me to wear the red Chucks. Well, that's all good. Very comfortable. But that's a little different, but it's now fashionable, and that's great because it goes terrific with the suits and ties and shirts and everything else, overcoats that you can get at the St. Louis Suit Company. And let me remind you, you know, I was talking to Joe here, who's, you know, our great producer, and I was pointing out to him that I've been walking around for 3 days now with this overcoat I've got. And, you know, people look at me like, what's that for? Well, guess what? Walk around outside and you'll find out what that's for, because this is St. Louis and they want to remind you that it's not over yet. This is not summer. So be careful. You got to dress up out there so you can be comfortable. And the place to go to get those great clothes are the St. Louis Suit Company in Clayton. And remember, the ties are $5, and they're good ties. Great silk ties, just like the ones you could get from Donald for $50. And the ones from Donald, of course, will choke you. And these, you'll be very comfortable and live a long and healthy life, because the St. Louis Suit Company is a great place that's been there for 29 years. Okay, so last night, after we left the studio, right around that time, the news broke that Donald managed to get his $175 million bond, which protects him from Letitia James, you know, that horrible person that wants to come in and take all his properties. And, you know, it's sort of interesting what happened. I've been saying for a while that it was highly probable that Donald would get his money from Vladimir Putin. But as it turns out, it doesn't look like that's true, although I wouldn't completely rule it out, because he actually got it from a guy named Don Henke. But we don't know where Henke got the money, but that's all right. I'm not going to worry about that right now. But the deal is $175 million posted by the Knight Specialty Insurance Company. Whoever heard of them? But at any rate, don't worry. They are a company that has put a ton of money into Donald Trump. And let me put it to you this way. You know, if you owe somebody a dollar, they're going to want their dollar for sure. And they're going to say, you know, can I have my dollar? And if you owe somebody $20, they'll probably do the same thing. But if you owe them $1 million and they know that you're maybe not able to come up with that money, the first thing that they're doing is they're thinking about what can they do to not get wiped out on this deal. They may have loaned the money to the wrong person, and now they want to make sure they get their million, and what they may have to do is they may have to loan you another $100,000 to keep you afloat so you don't go bankrupt on the whole thing and end up taking this person down. Well, that is exactly where Don Hankey and the special night people, night special insurance company, that's exactly where they find themselves. Because Donald is about a step away from having everything taken from him, which includes properties that have had money lent to Donald by the Knight Specialty Insurance Company. So this is a really bad situation for Don Hankey. He really had to come up with this $175 million because without it, all these properties that are backing up his previous loans, well, they'd have been in the hands of Letitia James. And Hankey wants his properties, if that's what it comes to. And he certainly wants his money back, but he can't get it from Donald because Donald doesn't have a penny. So Hankey steps up with wherever he got his money and he loans it to Donald so that perhaps somewhere down the line, this might work out for both Donald and for Don Hankey, because otherwise they're both down the tubes. So this is an interesting situation. There really wasn't much choice. This guy had to find a way to help Trump, and he did. Now, he's sort of an interesting person all by himself, because back when we had the bad situation with the housing market and all the money was lent to people who couldn't afford homes because they didn't qualify for the loans. You know, they were called subprime borrowers. Don Hankey was one of the leaders in doing this, in lending money to people who couldn't afford to pay it back. Gee, who does that sound like? Sounds like this is a perfect business for him. Loan Donald everything you can, because believe me, he can't pay anything back. So anyway, that's what Hankey did. And now he's trying to protect his investment. And I understand why, because Trump's going down the drain. That's for sure. And, you know, in fact, there was a guy today, and I like this guy. I never heard of him before. But I like him a lot. His name is Dr. John Gardner. And Dr. Gardner is a psychologist. And he has taught and done research at Johns Hopkins Medical Center for 28 years. I mean, this guy is highly regarded. Just somebody that the people in the psychology area really trust. Well, Gardner today says that from his observations, that it appears to him that Donald is just about ready to go over the cliff. And listen, I haven't been one day in medical school. I know I've got those PhD hours in educational psychology, but it's a different kind of psychology. I don't know anything about people that are about to go bonkers. But I can tell you This is the guy. Donald is the guy. I don't know who in the country is what, but I know what Donald is. And you know, you can ask his niece as well. Mary Trump will be happy to tell you all that she has seen in Donald over the last, you know, 25, 30 years or longer of her work in psychology. So anyway, I just thought it was, you know, sort of interesting that we've got somebody out here with some real credentials who is taking a good look at Donald and says he's, you know, the cliff, heading right over it. So we'll see how that goes. And I guess, you know, he was happy to get that $175 million that, you know, Donald was. But let me also add this, and I've pointed this out before, because, you know, I read, not very much of it, but I read some magazines and online reports. They're pretty bizarre. And these things talk about, you know, Donald Trump and, you know, all the ways that he's being mistreated and that everything, you know, all the bad things that are being done to him. You know, woe is poor Donald. You know, but in any event, Trump is being mistreated. But they do say that he did win one time when he got the $175 million reduction. That was a big win for Donald. But I do want to remind you, and I did talk about this the other day, it wasn't quite the win that Donald and his people are trying to point out. Because, in fact, what really happened is this. In addition to getting the lowered number on the bond, which the state of New York did that for a reason. They're not dumb. They want to make sure that they get something. This assures them of $175 million. Now, on the rest of it, the rest of the $450 million or $500 million, whatever it ends up at the end of all this appeal business, they can still go after it. They can still grab all the assets possible. They can still, you know, take the properties and so forth. But the point is, they've got a guarantee of $175 million. So that's what they wanted. They wanted to be sure they had something that was really locked in. So that's first. Now, the second thing is, when you are appealing a case like this, this is a civil fraud case in which Donald was found guilty of fraud. He defrauded the government. He defrauded insurance companies. He defrauded everybody he could. I mean, he lied about everything. He's still saying it. He says, you know, start it this way. They say, people, real estate people, say that his club is worth like $18 million, whatever it is, $28 million. Okay, call it whatever you want. I mean, there's a range in all of this. There's no doubt about that. Donald's always emphasizing that there's a range and some people have different views of all of this. But Donald says that it's worth 100 times that $28 million. 100 times. He claims that all of his properties are worth billions of dollars, things that no one else could sell for, you know, more than, you know, $5, $10 million for, you know, various properties. But in his view, it's all worth billions of dollars. Well, again, that I think that goes to John Gardner and the whole business of Donald going over the cliff. But I do want to point out what actually happened here. And that is that in this appeal process, you've got about 9 months to come up with the final information that you deliver to the court and that is perfected at the court in order to give the court the ability to come back and say, okay, we're going to evaluate what Trump says and we're going to figure out whether the appeal is justified or not. Now, The problem is Donald had 9 months. So 9 months added on to, say, whatever it was, the end of March. So that would take you to November after the election. And that would be November 25th, say, because it was March 25th that he was supposed to come up with the money for this. Anyway, the court and the state of New York said, we're going to give you the reduction to $175 million. But we're not giving you until November 25th. We're going to give you till July 1st. We want everything in, perfected, certified, whatever you want to call it. I didn't go to law school, but they want it in and done by July 1st. And that's a fact. That's the deal that was made. So the state of New York got two things out of this. They got a guarantee that they will get something. And then they also got this hurry up and get the appeal done process so that this would get out of the way in a relatively short period of time. Now, I don't know how long it'll take after the July 1st deadline is met, which will be met. Trust me, they're going to meet it, because if they don't, the courts are going to go bonkers on him. And they're going to listen. They're going to go bonkers on him anyway, because figure this one out. July 1st. Oh, that's a couple of months after the Manhattan trial gets underway, because that's going to start on the 15th. And today is the 2nd of April. And the 15th of April, that's the day the jury voir dire will begin. That's where they question the jurors and decide who they can keep and who they want to try to get rid of. And I can tell you that if that takes 2 weeks, and it might take three. You know, Donald's going to try to push this out as far as he can. But whatever it takes, the trial will then get underway, and it's going to be quick. It might take 4 weeks. It might take 6 weeks. I'm going to say everything is going to be said and done with a verdict by July 1st. So July 1st, which happens to be the date of the appeal process in the E. Jean Carroll. I'm sorry, wrong case. I mean, yeah, that's the other thing I love, is getting the cases wrong, because who can remember which case is which? But the civil fraud case, okay? The E. G. Carroll appeals, another story, and that's probably going to take a year because there isn't a special deal on that one. But on the fraud case, there is a special deal. July 1st, that has to be in and finished and on its way so that the judicial system can make some decisions about whether this $450 million verdict is a good one or not. And I'll bet you that if they take anything off that deal, it'll be $20 million. And so instead of $450 million, which by that time with interest, it's liable to be $550 million. So maybe they'll drop it to $530 million. He's going to pay. He is going to pay. And one of the reasons that's true, I'm not just saying it. This guy has spent 40 years defrauding everybody he could get to, including the state of New York, and especially the state of New York. That's where he's operated this whole time. And I can guarantee you that they are going to get what they're coming for here, and that is justice. I mean, they want justice. They are tired of Donald stepping all over the state of New York and everybody that he could, all the way back to the days when he wouldn't let black people rent apartments in New York. Yeah, don't forget that one. You can go look that up on Google anytime you want. This guy and his family have done everything imaginable. not good. So check it out. But at any rate, we're really focusing in on the end to some of these activities, like the fraud case, the E. Jean Carroll case. That's going to take a year. And then, of course, we're going to have the trial, the first criminal trial that's in my opinion, going to be over July 1st. But, hey, if I'm wrong and it's July 10th, sue me. Yeah, you won't win against me on this one the way you're going to win against Donald, because when it comes to suing Donald, suddenly people are winning. Okay, so that's part of the situation. And then let me also say that you know, Donald has a number of additional problems. For example, Hope Hicks, you know, this was some great friend of his. Hope Hicks, you know, she's been with him for many years, and presumably she still likes the guy. She acts like she does. She hasn't really turned on him at this point, but there's a subpoena out here, and she is going to have to tell the truth, because if she doesn't, they're going to get her for perjury. And I can assure you, she is going to respond to the subpoena, because she knows where Peter Navarro is in jail, and she does not want to be there. So she, along with other people, are definitely coming around to the idea that it's time to stop trying to protect Donald Trump at the expense of yourself personally. And that's why, you know, the Don Hankey story is really such a great one, because a lot of people today on Donald's side are trying to say, well, you know, Hankey recognizes the greatness of Trump and wants to give him all this money. No, that's not what's happening. What he's doing is protecting his own interests, because he owes far too much, or he's got far too much owed to him by Donald. And if he's not careful, he's going to end up with nothing. So, okay, so all these things are happening, and these are all, you know, good and interesting things. Here's one that I think is really worth taking a look at, and this is a case in Michigan where Donald and his people are pointing to an immigrant who ended up in Michigan with his, I believe it's his wife, don't quote me, could be a girlfriend, but whatever the situation, it's a partner. And this immigrant, first he had been thrown out under Trump, and then he came back, he got back in, which of course they want to blame on Joe Biden. And then when he got back in, he came back and he killed his partner. And so presumably this is evidence that immigrants are murderers. They'll kill their wives, their girlfriends, their partners. They'll do everything imaginably horrible, because that's just the way these people are. They just want to get you. Well, here's what I'd like you to do, because this one guy, this is what we call anecdotal information. It's one story. It's one example of something that none of us like. The guy was thrown out and he got back in. I mean, Joe Biden can't stand at the border and block everybody that's coming in. And the fact is that we do allow people in, and we should allow people in. Here is the point. If you go to my website, and the website is talkstl.net, and then there's a place where it tells you that you can read articles. I think it says reading room. And then you click it, and then you scroll down a little bit, and then you're going to find an article about immigrants. There we go. Joe's showing it to you right there. And in that reading room, there is a great article in the 2000s. It's you know, during the 2000s. It's not like 90 years ago. And it refers to the research done on people who come here from other countries, how much crime they commit, and how much crime is committed by people who already live here or people who were born here. And I have to tell you, the difference is enormous. That is, the people who are born in the United States commit the crimes. Our people, our American citizens, we are the ones who commit by far the vast number of these crimes, violent crimes, murder. It's us. We do it. The people who come from other countries, they come here to make their lives better, to work on the bridge in Baltimore. They're trying to help themselves. And in the process, they're truly helping us. And the statistics are by far pointing in that direction. This is not anything that has to do with people coming from other countries and murdering us. That's not what's going on. We're murdering ourselves because we've got guns that we shouldn't have. Get rid of the guns and we'll get rid of the murders. All of these people that show up and are involved in the mass murders that we have here, which no one sees in other countries, those people aren't from Venezuela. Those people aren't from the Dominican Republic. Those people aren't from Mexico. Those people are from the United States of America. And they've got guns that should never be in their hands. They shouldn't be near those guns. Now, I know that we've got some crazy idea that there's something called the Second Amendment. Well, let me tell you something. The Second Amendment does not say anything about you having the right to have a gun. Nothing. Zero. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, comma. Given that first statement, it has to do with a well-regulated state. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. You should know these words. You should be able to recite them. I can. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It is directly tied to this idea that the United States should have not a loose group of people wandering around with guns, a well-regulated militia. And by the way, in case you don't know, go look it up. The commander-in-chief of the militia is the President of the United States. That's the words in the Constitution. Now, I can tell you exactly who to read. Go find a book by Saul Cornell. Saul Cornell is a great constitutional scholar, and you can read him and find out all about the history of the Second Amendment. Because it is nothing like what you think it is. It has nothing to do with you being allowed to have a gun. Now, it is true that if the Supreme Court says that it means that, well, then that's what it means. Because that is our system. The Supreme Court has a right to twist themselves around like a pretzel and make up something that is not true. They can do it. But I promise you, it's not true. But this is what is true. This is the end of the show. This is Showdown. I'm Mark Kaysen. See you tomorrow night. And by the way, my guest tomorrow night will be Vic Faust. See you then. Good night.